America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman broadcasting live today from the Air America studios here in New York City. It is the relaunch of Air America 2.0, and we will be having more about that in the second and third hours of the program. And we have some interviews with Elliot Spitzer and let's see, what else do we have here? So David Brooks and Howard Dean. It's going to be a whole bunch of interesting folks here visiting with us, and an awful lot of interesting stuff going on. So we'll be getting into these things as time goes on. Interesting article in today's Wall Street Journal. China puts cash to work in deal with Blackstone. This, actually, before I get into this, I just wanted to mention 60 Minutes last night. This absolutely made me crazy. I arrived in New York yesterday afternoon. I flew in from Albuquerque after doing a gig in Santa Fe day before yesterday for our Santa Fe affiliate, KTRC, and the day before that in Denver for Talk 760, Progressive Talk. And was watching last night with my friend Jerry Schneiderman here in the city that I'm staying with, was watching the 60 Minutes. I believe it was 60 Minutes. It was one of those news shows. Probably wasn't, whatever it was. In any case, no, it was a replay of Face the Nation. And the first part was a political debate. And then they got on these three Reagan guys. You know, there's a new Reagan biography. And I said, oh, geez, they're going to reinvent Reagan. I mean, this is part of the process. Nobody's going to talk about the fact that he tripled our national debt. Nobody's going to talk about you know, all of the damage that he did to this country, that you know, he began the war on unionization. He came into office. We had 25% unionization. Now we're at 7% in the private sector. Nobody's going to talk about you know, what he did to our standing around the world. Nobody, they're going to make all these positive claims. And sure enough, it was let's reinvent Reagan. But anyway, all the more of the tragedy. I'll share a little more about that with you. This, of course, you know, what George W. Bush is planning on doing with this $500 million effort to put into the Bush Library to reinvent his history. But right now, we have with us Valerie Huber. She is the executive director of the National Abstinence Education Association, abstinenceassociation.org, excuse me, is the website, abstinenceassociation.org. And Valerie, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me.
Am I pronouncing your last name right, Huber?
You are.
Great.
Yes.
Okay. There seems to be a little bit of dissonance here. First of all, I think it's important for our listeners to realize abstinence-only education has become a $1.1 billion industry. You are the executive director of the association that represents that industry. It is almost entirely funded with taxpayer dollars. That's our dollars. And most of the recipients of this are religious organizations, although textbook manufacturers are doing very well these days as well. And what has happened is that Bush wants to double funding on abstinence education. There's, what is it, $400 million that is up before Congress to add to the $1 billion that's already been spent?
Well, as you probably know, abstinence education really got its jump start when President Clinton signed Title V into law back
in 1981.
Yeah,
in 1981.
1996.
Oh, it was 96. I'm
yep.
Sorry. Well, the beginning of it was in 81, I believe, that there was you know, was the first what was called the Chastity Act, the Chastity Law back in that day. But in any case, yeah, I don't dispute that. And I'm not trying to make this a Republican or Democratic thing. But the dissonance here is the CDC, as you I'm sure you well know, the Centers for Disease Control recently did a study finding that abstinence only, not only is education in our schools is not only a bad thing, is not only not a good thing, but it's actually a bad thing. In Minnesota, for example, they found that sexual activity doubled among junior high school students when they started taking part in abstinence only programs as opposed to comprehensive sexual education programs. Why do you continue to promote these abstinence-only programs?
Well, it's actually really important that we're not selective in looking at the research, pointing out only those that don't show success in abstinence education. As you may or may not know, there are a number of peer-reviewed journals, articles that actually show that abstinence education is currently being funded by Congress, has been very successful in a number of areas. First of all, in delaying sexual onset, reducing number of partners among those students who choose to remain sexually active after having been sexually experienced, but many of them who take abstinence education classes actually decide to become abstinent again, even though they have been sexually experienced.
You know, actually, I actually have your list here. Mm-hmm. It's off your website, which, you know, again, is abstinenceassociation.org. And I don't read these studies the same way you do. I'm sorry. For example, your very first one, the YRBSS Trends in the Prevalence of Sexual Behavior from the CDC, it shows a 13% decline in the proportion of U.S. teens who have initiated sexual activity between 1991 and 2005. In other words, in 1991, 54% of teens were sexually active, and in 2005, 47%. First of all, it's, yeah, a 13% decline is a thing to celebrate, but that has nothing to do necessarily with abstinence-only education. It may well be the fact that there's, you know, more information out there about AIDS and chlamydia and all of the other downside consequences of sexual activity, and that our society is in some ways becoming, you know, more concerned about things like long-term relationships and you know, rather than, you know, the anything goes stuff.
Well, I would certainly hope that to be the case, and actually that's a part of what is taught in abstinence education. And it's really not abstinence-only education. We really don't like that moniker given to it because it's really a very holistic approach that talks about building self-esteem and developing good character that will help in formulating positive goals, making decisions, avoiding risky behaviors, yes, sexual activity, risky sexual activity being one of them. But
you don't want birth control taught.
Well, actually, that's another thing that's a mischaracterization of what abstinence education does.
We're talking about abstinence-only education, which is what George W. Bush wants to fund, abstinence-only education.
It's abstinence education as defined by Congress, but we would not call it abstinence-only education.
But that's what it is by law. That you can, if you're going to talk about sex in the classroom, you can only talk about abstinence. And in fact, if you look at the groups that are getting the funding for this, it's the Baptist Collegiate Ministries, the Diocese of Lafayette, the Concerned Christian Women of Livingston, the Catholic Charities, the Christian Counseling Center, the Community Christian. I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars going to these organizations. You have public schools all across the United States who regularly host chastity pledges and rallies at which students are required to pledge to God that they will remain abstinent until they marry. And
well,
these are put on officially by the schools.
As I appreciate your characterization, but it's just not accurate.
It is accurate. These are from
abstinence education permits an age-appropriate discussion of contraception, just not.
So, what's the age at which discussion at which contraception should be discussed?
Most abstinence programs begin that discussion junior or senior high, but it's not an.
So senior high. So somebody who's 17 is when you should tell them that there's such a thing as contraception.
In junior and senior high, an age-appropriate discussion of contraception is permitted in abstinence education programs. However, not advocacy nor demonstration. And you're probably familiar with a recent Zogby poll that we commissioned that showed that that's exactly the kind of discussion that most American parents want, regardless of ideology.
Well, and in fact, I read the poll on your website too, and you know, I encourage people to go over there and check it out, and abstinenceassociation.org, and there weren't very many questions there with which I would disagree. Again, it didn't seem to be characterizing abstinence only. Most of the questions were fairly rational. I mean,
I think you've illustrated exactly what we were hoping to accomplish with that poll, and that is that abstinence education has been mischaracterized by and large, and we wanted to set the record straight.
But it hasn't been. And in the United States, I mean, we have the highest teenage pregnancy rate in the world. Teenagers are the second largest cohort of people getting AIDS in the world. And according to the CDC in their most recent study, this is because of these federal abstinence-only education programs.
I don't think that I've seen that CDC study that you're referring to. If you're referring to the Mathematica study that just came out, that was commissioned by HHS and only talked about four of over 700 programs, none of which represent what abstinence education programs are teaching today.
Well, okay. Valerie Hubert, thank you for being with us. She's the executive director of the National Abstinence Education Association, abstinenceassociation.org. Good talking with you.
Thank you for having me.
16 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program, live from New York. It's Air America 2.0.
Is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here, broadcasting live from the Air America studios in Washington, D.C. Chris Lopresto, competently, brilliantly running the board, and Lauren Kirshner answering the phones. We're having a great old time to hear today. A billion-dollar industry really can have some articulate spokespeople, and our last guest did a great job of representing the industry. Unfortunately, every reputable sexuality education organization in the U.S., including fringe groups like the American Medical Association, have denounced abstinence-only sexuality programs. A 1997 consensus statement from the National Institutes of Health concluded that legislation discouraging condom use on the grounds that condoms are ineffective places policy in direct conflict with science. Well, gee, I guess that shouldn't surprise us. The programs also don't work. When they do become sexually active, teens who received abstinence-only education often fail to use condoms or other contraceptives. In fact, 88% of students who pledge virginity in middle school and high school still engage in premarital sex, and the students who break this pledge are less likely to use contraception at first intercourse. I don't think anybody is saying that, wouldn't it be a great thing if more teenagers were having sex. That's not the point. And certainly the values and virtues of abstinence should be taught in our schools as part of a sex education program. But to not talk about what's really going on, what's really available, what are these sexually transmitted diseases? Very rationally would suggest that every one of us is going to have to balance a checkbook at some point in our lives. We should be teaching that in our schools. Many of us are going to end up changing a baby's diapers at some point in our lives. We should be teaching parenting in our schools. And the vast majority of us are going to engage in sexual activity at some point in our lives. We should be teaching that in our schools. What is it? How does it work? What are the moral and religious implications, but also what are the biological and health implications? But because there is this loud fringe on the right that doesn't want this discussed at all outside of the context of perhaps the church or the home, and they've been around with us for a long, long time, and we've seen the results of this. We in the United States have rates of teenage pregnancy and teenage disease, sexually transmitted disease, twice that of European nations that have comprehensive sexual education in their high schools and in their junior high schools. And in those communities, like California, for example, when California went to 10 years ago, went to comprehensive sex ed as a result of a state law, they saw their rates of teenage pregnancy and the incidence of disease, sexually transmitted disease among teenagers, drop to that of the European levels, drop in half. And yet we have given over $1 billion so far to largely religious organizations, many of them for-profit, many of them not-for-profit, but it is a billion-dollar industry, and Bush wants to give another. He came into office pledging to give $200 million, $155 million the first year. Now he wants to give $400 million, more and more money, and here you have this now a lobbying arm. It's become an industry. So it's grim. Now, with regard to Reagan's legacy, I don't want to miss this because this was what I was just astounded. This was pathetic. Tim Russert sitting there with two guys who worked for Reagan, Michael Deaver and Ed Meese, as I recall, and the guy who just wrote the biography, or not a biography, it was a collection of his diary notes, and you know didn't point out the fact that in 81 he fired the 12,000 air traffic controllers. And began the era of the end of labor. Real median wages did not grow during the decade of the 80s when you adjust for inflation. He caused economic damage internationally. He changed the policies of the Monetary Fund, the World Bank. This whole era of structural adjustment, that all came out of Reagan's policies, or Reaganomics. It became the lost decade, the 80s, for Latin America. I was down in Argentina as they were coming out of this stuff back about 8 or 10 years ago. It was amazing that, you know, the middle class had just been largely wiped out. Reagan is credited with having caused the collapse of the Soviet Union. Sorry, back in the 60s, the CIA was presenting that this was going to happen. It had nothing to do with it. Overthrew a democratically elected government introduced efforts to do so in 84, the Nicaragua, the Contras, continued to run the war from the basement of the White House and paid for it with proceeds from illegal arms sales to Iran in exchange for hostages. And there were no hostages. So what were those hostages? What could they have been, the hostages of 1980? The Republicans succeeded in preventing that from being investigated. I mean, it just boggled my mind that the extraordinary level of damage that Ronald Reagan has inflicted on this nation and the world, and that his policies continue to inflict, that this was a major turning point. None of that was discussed on the Tim Russert show. Instead, it was all, oh, wasn't he a great guy? Yeah, he was very thoughtful. You know, he didn't always get along with his children, especially Ron. You know, he's a liberal now. And it's like, this is news these days, or this is even commentary? Well, I guess this is what the networks are all about. What can you say? A lot of the news. We'll give you a quick summary when we come back from the break and be taking your calls at 866-303-2270, 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Well, apparently it's not always, what would you call it, date rape, I guess? Gonzalez claims he can tell Bush no. This is the question. Gonzalez being questioned by Congress. Do you recall a time when you were in there, that would be the White House, and said, Mr. President, we can't do this, Gonzalez was asked. Oh, yeah, the Attorney General responded. Can you share it with us, a reporter asked. No, Gonzalez said. So, yeah, he can say no to Bush. And then the follow-up question, I mean, and nobody asked the follow-up question, is when you said no to him, did he say, okay, I'll go your way? Or you know, I'm going to do it anyway. Anyhow, and there's a reason why the whole Gonzo Gate matters, and it's the editorial, one of the lead editorials in today's New York Times, and it's a really good one. They know it's always been understood that although they are appointed by the president, usually from his own party, once federal prosecutors are in office, they must operate in a nonpartisan way and be insulated from outside pressures. And these are people who have incredible power. They can wiretap people's homes, seize property, put people in jail for life. They can destroy businesses, affect the outcomes of elections. This understanding that they must operate independent of political considerations, says the New York Times this morning in their editorial, this understanding has badly broken down. The degree of partisanship in the department is shocking. A study by two professors, Donald Shields of the University of Missouri at St. Louis and John Cragen of Illinois State University, found that the Bush Justice Department has investigated Democratic office holders and office seekers about four times as often as Republican ones. Our justice system has been perverted for political purposes. They go on to point out it's not hard to see the fingerprints of Karl Rove. A disproportionate number of the prosecutors pushed out or considered for dismissal were in swing states. The main reason for the purge? Apart from hobbling a California investigation that has already put one Republican congressman in jail, appears to have been an attempt to tip states like Missouri and Washington to Republican candidates for House, Senate, Governor, and President. Congress has to save the Justice Department. And I would say, do something really, you know, quite serious about this effort to corrupt the Justice Department that seems to have begun with the Bush White House and the Bush presidency, but also is being aggressively promoted by the Republican Party. And here we are back to the Republican Party acting like, you know, the mob. And do we need to bring in the RICO Act here? Giving, you know, $1 billion to their buddies in the abstinence-only field, you know, $1 billion just in the last year, just in 2006, to faith-based programs, code word for churches, $1 billion. That's $1,000 million. I mean, can you imagine $1 billion? Boy, what we could do with $1 billion on this network. I mean, you know, what is it? The whole, you know, back in, now, Air America, this is Air America 2.0. We are relaunching it. The Green family has come in and bought the company out of bankruptcy, but it went into bankruptcy over what? $16 million or something like that? I mean, it was peanuts. And Bush wants to give $1,000 million. Well, it did last year just to churches, just to groups like Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell. Oh, well. Enough of that rant. I want to share one other quick thing with you, then we'll go to your calls. And this is the synthesis of two stories that are in today's New York Times and the gotcha nobody is talking about. The first is an article by Andrew Ross Sorkin in the Times. It's on page A15. It's buried in the paper. Alltel, the wireless phone company, agreed last night to be sold to a consortium of private equity firms for $27.5 billion. $27,500 million. Barking the biggest buyout ever in the telecommunications industry. It's the latest to the large private company to go private amid a frenzy of deal-making among private equity firms. Now, what does this mean? When a company becomes private, it's requirement that a lot of its documentation of how it conducts business and what it does in business and where the money goes and all that goes away in terms of their requirement to let us know what's going on. So you see companies like, I believe Bechtel is a private corporation, and Steven Bechtel is this incredibly rich guy, but incredibly secretive. Nobody's really knows what's going on inside Bechtel, other than that they, you know, help bring Reagan to power and all this sort of thing. So number one, when companies go private, they go secret. And number two, as companies are going private, there are now like these groups that are organized for the purpose of buying companies, and then the groups themselves are private. Or in many cases they're going private, or they manage companies going private. And that, which brings us to the other big story, and this is in today's Wall Street Journal. It starts on page one, actually, and it should be on page one. And that is that China, which is sitting on $1.2 trillion. $1 trillion is $1,000 billion, and $1 billion is $1,000 million. I mean, we're talking mind-boggling amounts of money here. $1.2 trillion, which has traditionally been invested, much of it has been traditionally been invested in U.S. Treasury notes. In other words, we borrow from the Chinese. We give them IOUs called Treasury notes. We pay them a fairly low interest rate, 3, 4, 5%, whatever it happens to be at the time. And that allows our government to continue operating. Well, now they're looking, instead of putting that money back into the United States, because we have this huge trade deficit. We're buying all this stuff from them, and we're having to borrow money from them in order to buy it by selling them our treasuries. And they're sitting on all this U.S. money. I mean, this $800 billion a year that we give to the Chinese, that is more than we don't give to them. We buy their stuff, so they end up with $800 billion. But they haven't been buying our stuff because we don't make anything in this country anymore. So what are they doing? Well, here's where it gets really interesting. Today's Wall Street Journal. The headline, China puts cash to work in deal with Blackstone. The sides found each other. Blackstone is a private equity firm. Remember private equity firms we were talking about just a second ago? Early this year, the Chinese government announced it was looking for a place to invest a portion of its $1.2 trillion in foreign exchange reserves. Not long after, private equity firm Blackstone Group launched plans to raise money in an initial public offering. The sides found each other in dramatic fashion yesterday when China said it would invest $3 billion in Blackstone. And this article of Kate Leinenbaugh in Hong Kong, Henry Sender in New York, Andrew Batson or Bateson in Beijing contributed to it in today's Wall Street Journal. In continued investment, U.S. equities could help restore, they say, some equilibrium to China's accounts with the U.S. and thus alleviate one of the biggest sore points between Washington and Beijing. Now, let's break that down. Okay, the Chinese are going to come into the United States, and they're going to invest in a company that owns companies. Now, we've talked before about, you know, with absolute unrestrained laissez-faire capitalism, you end up with the big fish eating the, you know, first of all, the medium-sized fish eat the small fish, and then the big fish eat the medium-sized fish, and then the big fish start eating each other, and then pretty soon you're left with nothing but a small handful of very big fish. And that's the direction it's been going ever since Reagan came into office, with the mergers and acquisitions mania, when Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, another thing that they didn't talk about yesterday on Tim Russert's show. So China now is sitting on all this money, so what are they going to do? Instead of loaning it back to us in the form of treasuries, they're going to start buying us. Do you get what's going on here? The United States is having to put itself up for sale because we're buying so much junk from China because of these insane so-called free trade policies that have moved all of our manufacturing capacity, or so much of our manufacturing capacity to China, that in order to buy anything, pretty much. I mean, the computer that I'm looking at right now is made in China. The pants that I'm wearing right now are probably made in China. I know that the shirt I'm wearing right now was made somewhere in the Far East. I think it was Malaysia. As the Wall Street Journal says, as China seeks to more actively manage its burgeoning reserves, the U.S. is still likely to be the destination for most of its investment. Well, isn't that reassuring? But instead of steering the vast majority to the U.S. Treasuries market, Beijing is likely to seek higher returning vehicles that promise profit rather than safety. And now, there should be screaming alarm bells around this article on the front page of today's Wall Street Journal. What happens when China starts buying our companies with that money rather than buying our treasuries? Number one, it means that our government won't be able to operate anymore. They're going to have to start raising dramatically the amount of interest that we pay on the debt that Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush ran up, the two of them having run up more debt than all other presidents in the history of the nation. And by the way, this isn't just limited to China. As the Wall Street Journal notes in the article, the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority bought up nearly half of Apollo Management's listed investment vehicles last year. This is the first time a government, is investing the heart of a private equity firm. By investing in private equity firms, foreign investors are hoping to deflect some of the criticism by going in with a local partner. For example, they're not buying Blackstone, they're just investing in it. Looks like it's going to be about a $40 billion IPO. They're buying $3 billion. And so we say, well, you know, they're not just buying America, they're just buying little pieces of it. And everybody's saying, oh, that's just fine. It's just a little piece. Well, it's just a little piece now, and it's just a little piece of this company. But what we really need to do is restore some rationality to our international trade policies. We need to change it so that things are made in the United States, so that we're buying things from American companies to sell to Americans, as does every other country in the world. In the meantime, in the secret, in the background, the United States is negotiating a deal with the European Union to create sort of a one-world trade zone. You know, we're well on the road here to 6 billion people competing with every single one of us as workers. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Well, one can hope. Actually, it is. And frankly, in my opinion, it's coming back. 1-866-303-2270, our phone number. Max in L.A., California. Hey, Max.
Hey. Good morning, Tom. Another legacy of Ronald Reagan you forgot was the introduction of the survival of the fittest mentality
right.
into American society. But the reason I called, you talked about how they want to reinvent Reagan. They have done that. A couple of years ago, there was a show on called The Greatest American. It ran for several weeks. They started out with 100 or 200 Americans, and it was a vote-down show.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd eventually find the greatest American. And the final two were Abraham Lincoln and Ronald Reagan. And Ronald Reagan won.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's popularity. It's one of those things people vote online. So, you know, it's hardly valid. But sad.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, no, they have been working at this literally. Well, actually, they began working at it during his administration. And, you know, he was referred to as the Teflon president. And in part, it was because of the relationship that he had with the press. And a lot of the techniques that he fine-tuned or that he really started were fine-tuned under Bush Sr. and not always particularly effectively, and have been elevated to an art form now by Karl Rove and George W. Bush. Now, you're absolutely right, and the reinvention of Ronald Reagan is, I think, in my opinion, one of the most destructive things that's happening in the United States, because nobody's talking about what his actual policies and philosophies were. Everybody talks about what a nice guy he was. Well, maybe he was a nice guy. You know, I'm sure he probably was a nice guy. That doesn't mean he was a good president. Max in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Max.
Yes, good morning. This is Max in St. Louis. Well, I was calling you specifically at the top of your show. I'm glad you brought it up. First, the Russert show. And let me just cut through it all. I hope they find some more Reagan diaries where Reagan refers to Russert as
appreciate it. 1-866-303-2270. Mark in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Mark.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Where to begin? I mean, there's so much going on. Your interview earlier with the woman from the Abstinence Association, is that a front for a religious organization, or is that,
it is a trade industry group for what has become an industry. I mean, when you've got $1 billion a year industry, it's entirely appropriate reasonable that there be a group that kind of acts on behalf of the industry, that everybody in the industry kicks a little money into, and then they go out and they do the lobbying and they do the public relations, and that's what that group was.
I was amazed to hear that they would only start in the junior or senior year talking about sex education in the schools. I mean, puberty among kids is getting younger and younger and younger,
yeah,
in terms of all the chemicals and the BGH and everything that's in our food.
Well, not only do we have kids becoming sexually mature at the ages, you know, tragically at the ages of 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 when they're still in elementary school, but we also have a multi-hundred-billion-dollar industry promoting sex as a means of selling products to that same cohort, and nobody is talking to them about the consequences of that, other than saying you need to take a pledge or whatever. Actually, they're not even saying that. I mean, they're not even doing abstinence-only education in the elementary school. So it's to the best of my knowledge. So it's tragic, and it's a disaster, and it's an ongoing thing. Keith in Livonia, Michigan. Hey, Keith.
Yes. Hey, Tom. Great program. I wanted to add to your laundry list of Reagan revisionist history. It's really takes me back. Let's not forget that, you know, that champion of democracy, Ronald Reagan, supported apartheid in South Africa. He supported the Marcos dictatorship in the Philippines. He supported death squads in El Salvador. In fact, one time I recall George Shultz, who was the Secretary of State later in his term, gave the red carpet treatment to Roberto Dabasson,
right,
who used to be nicknamed Blowtorch Bob. This was an administration that thought of nuclear war as something that was winnable. This is an administration that began the dismantlement of federal housing for low income. Homelessness was virtually unheard of before the Reagan years.
Right. And Reagan shutting down mental hospitals on the one hand and cutting back on programs that, that LBJ had put in place. LBJ cut poverty in this country in half in 4 years.
Yeah.
And Reagan undid it. And, you know, and his story of the welfare queen that he just made up out of whole cloth.
Yeah.
You know, this so-called woman who drove in her Cadillac to collect her welfare check. There was no such person. The newspaper said, well, you know, show us such a person.
Do you recall how he sought to reclassify ketchup as a vegetable in school lunch programs?
Yeah, and let us not forget James Watt, his Secretary of the Interior, who was selling off interior lands for pennies on the dollar to good, you know, good Republican friends of the Reagan administration. And then when he was asked why, you know, isn't this a problem, sort of, that we're despoiling these lands, that these mines are, you know, gold mines are leaching arsenic and all this other stuff. And by the way, that a lot of this is being done by foreign corporations. Only over 60% of the mining in the United States now is owned by companies outside the United States. They now own our resources. And a lot of that sale off began during Reagan. And Reagan's Secretary of the Interior, James Watt, said, it doesn't matter. Jesus is coming soon and all things will be made new.
Yeah, and to top this all off, let's just recall that a lot of the people who were key movers and shakers in the Reagan administration are in the,
they're
the
back again.
Bush administration.
They're back again, exactly. Well said, Keith. Philip in Tampa, Florida. Hey, Philip, we just have about a half a minute before we have to wrap this hour up.
I try to do it as quickly as possible. I lost, as a function of this pet food thing, I lost my Persian cat of my best cat.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, Philip. And it's really a function of, talk to Tom Friedman about it. I mean, this is a function of 26 years of insane promotion of so-called free trade policies.
Well, that's my point, is that I bought this product that was bought at Walmart. And can I give the name of the company?
I think the names are all fairly public, but
I sacrificed my cat on the altar of Bush's fair trade.
There you go. And it's not just Bush's. It was also Clinton's, and it was also Bush Senior's, and it was also Reagan's. And you know, done probably with the best. And thank you, Philip, for sharing your story. And I'm sorry that you lost your cat. I know how difficult that is. And maybe on the altar of best intentions, but still, we know now it doesn't work. Isn't it time to change our policy? Air America 2.0.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio. You're tuned into the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you live from New York City at the world headquarters, the nerve center, the mother hive of Air America Radio. And this is the relaunch of Air America. This is Air America 2.0. And we're going to, today and tomorrow, we're going to be doing some things that are relatively out of character for this program as part of that. And a fine thing it is, I think, you know, sometimes to have a little change of pace. And the first is an interview that the president of Air America, who's going to be joining us in right after this interview during the next break, Mark Green, president of Air America, did with the governor of New York, Elliot Spitzer, very recently. And so here's that.
This is Mark Green. I'm very pleased to be here today with Governor Elliot Spitzer on the relaunch of Air America 2.0. Governor Spitzer, thank you for joining Air America.
Mark, it is great to be chatting with you on air, as it's been great to chat with you for many years in our careers in public service.
I'm humbled, and I have to agree. Princeton and Harvard Law School, and Elliot Spitzer became a prosecutor in the renowned office of District Attorney Bob Morgenthau in Manhattan, before Law & Order hired a Tennessean named Fred Thompson to ridiculously play him. And then Elliot Spitzer became a two-term attorney general, attracting national attention because of his pioneering cases against Wall Street fraud, against a somnambulant environmental protection agency, against predatory lenders. Governor, if you're in a room and someone shouts out, Mr. Attorney General, does your head turn, or are you used to being governor now, four months later?
I still flinch when I see headlines about AGs, and especially the AG down in Washington, where He is rightfully, that department has been almost run into the ground by a Bush administration that doesn't understand the unique task of what an attorney general is supposed to do. And so, yes, I still carry with me the notion of what an attorney general should be and should be doing, and I still identify myself with that role. But look, I also respond when people call governor, which is something that I guess I'm getting used to. But I think there's something about being a lawyer and believing in law enforcement and the rule of law, which is a broader concept that makes me feel emotionally attached to an attorney general's office and view that office in the judiciary with the unique respect that I think, unfortunately, is being lost these days in Washington, and that is something that is treacherous for our nation.
Well, I can understand your muscle memory problem. President Bill Clinton, 7 years into his presidency, told me that the greatest job he ever held and thinks he will ever hold was Attorney General of the state of Arkansas when he's a 28-year-old young man. He could sue bad people.
You know, Mark, there's a reason for that. And there is a purity to being Attorney General, to being the voice for enforcement of legal principles that, and there's, I don't want to say simplicity in the sense of it's not difficult, it's very difficult to do it properly, but an ethical simplicity compared to the task of being a governor, for instance, where life is complicated by the need to negotiate with a legislative branch, and there are issues now that do not lend themselves to the clarity of the right and wrong of law enforcement.
Let me talk about some of those issues.
Sure.
You ran on, when you won your election last year, on sort of two issues, among others, reforming the upstate economy, which is in the ditch.
Yep.
Also, reforming Albany, your slogan is extremely effective.
Right.
You would have won without it, but it was extremely effective. On day one, everything changes. Why was Albany, let's tell our national audience, why did you think Albany was so ripe for systemic political reform?
Well, Albany has been deemed, and you can quibble with how they came to this conclusion perhaps, but Albany was deemed by the Brennan Center, an eminent academic institute affiliated with New York University, Albany was deemed to be the most dysfunctional state capital based upon an analysis of decision-making, openness, transparency, or lack thereof, capacity to resolve easy issues or difficult issues, the inflow of money that had tainted and, if not tainted, appeared to taint in a significant way decision-making, the role of lobbyists. And so there was a sense that we had ossified and become stagnant in a way that was contributing in a very real way to the economic decline of upstate New York. And the public has felt disenfranchised by the series of both campaign finance, gerrymandering, lobbyist issues that overlaid on top of an incumbency reelection rate of 98% to 99%. That gave the public the sense that they no longer had any say in decision-making.
That's good. So it wasn't merely unethical or unappetizing that big interests gave big money to big politicians, but your point is that it then led to bad decisions like those that didn't adequately produce jobs upstate.
So the public cares more at the end of the day about outcomes and substance than process.
Right.
Some of us, people can say, oh, gee, why do you care so much about process? We care about process because we understand that if the process is flawed, then the outcomes will suffer. The public is screaming for jobs, lower taxes, a more vibrant economy, investment in good health care and education. We understand that to transform the circumstances that will permit us to get there, mm-hmm. we need to change the political culture because the stagnation of the political culture is what is making it impossible to challenge the ossified system.
Well, there are three changes that you've been talking about. Let's just talk about them in our little time. I'll just tick them off. Money in politics, ethics in lobbying, and what's called gerrymandering, or redistricting districts. First on money, when you run for office in New York City, maximum gift is give or take $5,000, and then there's public matching funds. The first $250 you raise, the public treasury matches it 4-1. You run for state office, the maximum gift is not $5,000, but now $55,000, and there's no public money.
Correct.
What is your vision and your bill on how to change that?
Mark, it is too much, and what I have done unilaterally, and you know, there's a tension in all this, which I can get to quickly, but I have said I will not accept more than $10,000, even though the limit is $55,000. I think that's just too much. It creates an appearance issue. So unilaterally, I've given away 80% of what I can receive, and there are many donors out there who would give the $55,000 to a sitting governor if I called and asked, many for the right reason, some perhaps for the wrong reason, who knows. But I've said I will not accept more than 10. And I've challenged others to match that and to live by that standard. But more importantly, I'm trying to craft common sense campaign finance reform. Step one is common sense limits that should be much, much lower than where they are right now, and mm-hmm. we are outliers nationally. Step two would be public financing, if not identical to New York City. One could even go to pure public financing. There are different models out there, but certainly public financing is what we have to do. It's very hard to get a legislative branch that has grown dependent upon this flow of money to embrace the idea. It's a challenge to incumbents. They don't necessarily want to do it, but we're working at it, and I'm trying to bring to bear the pressure of editorial boards and good government groups and the public.
Joe Bruno, our national audience should know, is the Republican 78-year-old, quite vigorous, former boxer and current head of the state Senate. He says that your bill and approach helps incumbents, helps rich people.
Right.
Of course, Mike Waldman of the Brennan Center for Justice that you cited before has responded, well, then why aren't incumbents and rich people for it already? Exactly. What's your view of the Bruno attack?
Joe's logic is completely inverted. The current system that permits almost an unlimited flow of money from the wealthy and the established institutions is what perpetuates the stagnation of Albany and perpetuates the role of the wealthy and the status quo. What I'm trying to do is strip that away by dramatically lowering the capacity of the wealthy to send money into the system. Joe is simply saying something that is flat-out false and disingenuous, but he's doing it to cover up an opposition to campaign finance reform that is injurious to the system. It is one of the battles we have here, and it's one that I'll continue to wage. We will be successful in due course. It will take some time, but we will get there.
Well, principal conservatives at George Will, perhaps the New York Post, argue that money is speech. If you limit the amount of money a candidate can raise, you limit the amount of money he or she can spend and therefore speak to the public. That is quite literally mm-hmm. money talks. Do you think about that argument legally and politically?
They're wrong on both counts. The Supreme Court has said that money does not equal speech, and therefore you can constitutionally, within the confines of the First Amendment, limit campaign contributions. One's ability to speak on one's own behalf is unbounded and unlimited, as it should be, and that's the Buckley v. Valeo case, mm-hmm. even though we could. I would like to see it overruled for other reasons. It creates its own problems. But the Supreme Court has said very clearly, money does not equal speech when it is in the form of a campaign contribution. So we can, and in fact, for the integrity of the system, should limit those contributions. So I think there are many principled individuals out there who disagree. I think they're wrong. It can be a principled disagreement. The opposition we're facing in Albany is not that principled opposition, but it's an opposition designed to preserve a status quo that is broken.
Last two reform issues that you're working on in our last few minutes. Ethics and lobbying reform. You have gotten the state Senate and the Assembly to agree
yes.
to a new commission on public integrity. Is this deck chairs in the Titanic time, or why do
no,
you think
I,
this
I
will
think
change
we
things?
Got a new ethics bill. In fact, you listed three areas, so campaign finance, ethics, and then finally it was gerrymandering, mm-hmm. which is the most difficult, perhaps. But so we're one for three. We got campaign finance, as we just said, we are making progress. We're not there. Gerrymandering, we're nowhere yet because that is the most difficult for legislators. The second, ethics reform, we got a good bill through, both better enforcement in the form of one commission that will be chaired by the incredible John Furyk, who mm-hmm. speaks, whose very voice denotes ethics here in New York State. He has been the dean of those who pursue ethics issues throughout his career. So he will chair that effort, and that is a real step forward. We got bans on gifts. We got bans on the revolving door. We got greater disclosure.
Right.
We enacted many of the important ethics reforms we had sought. So that was a very good bill that moved us significantly forward.
On gerrymandering, where New York State is very blue, very Democratic, yeah. For governor, for president, for assembly. For state Senate, though, it's still 33-29 Republican. I mean, I think most fair-minded people would say it's because of they rig districts so they can get reelected. How the hell do you change a system that benefits incumbents when incumbents have to vote to change the process that elects them?
It is a question of bringing to bear public pressure. Again, editorial boards, and over time, you pick up enough marginal elected officials who understand the shame of the system they're living with. Again, it's not easy, but what we are proposing is a completely neutral, nonpartisan effort to draw lines that are not drawn to preserve incumbents, but are drawn to create fair districts and true democracy. Anytime you have 99%, 98% of incumbents winning, intuitively you know there is something wrong.
I don't know the answer to this question. When Arnold Schwarzenegger tried a good version of what Governor Spitzer, what you're trying to do, in a public referendum,
right,
not through the legislature, it lost in the blue state of California. Have you studied that? Why did he lose and you might win?
Well, I think part of what happened in California was that it was one of many referenda, the initiatives, I guess they're called in California, that were on the ballot that day that had a distinctly overly and dramatically conservative tilt to them, at least as perceived by the public generally. And there was an enormous battle, a titanic battle of wills, and the individual initiatives were not viewed on their merits, but I think everybody viewed it as an up or down vote on what was then a sort of a dramatic agenda that Governor Schwarzenegger proposed, and I think he lost every one of his initiatives that day. Had he presented them individually, it would have been viewed on their individual merits, and I think the gerrymandering bill or anti-gerrymandering bill might have succeeded because people would have understood it to be a good pro-reform movement. So I think it got lost in the dust of a much larger battle that day.
If Bobby Kennedy is remembered for rolled up sleeves and maybe FDR for his jutting jaw and cigarette lighter, you've been teased,
right,
or admired for being, in a word you once used, the steamroller. You began, let's end by the way you began,
right,
that sometimes it's harder, it's easier to prosecute bad people than collaborate with all people. Is the a phrase thrown at you that you're a steamroller helpful to get your way or hurtful because people don't want to cooperate with you?
You need to, I would say this, you need to know how to modulate, but you also need to know how to stand up for the principles in a determined and forceful way. If you are do not enter a situation like that, which we face here in New York, with the grit and the willpower to forge ahead and to accept and brook no disagreement and get to where you need to go, you'll never succeed in anything. We did get ethics reform. We got workers' comp reform. We got civil confinement. We got a budget that will guarantee health insurance for every kid and put more into education than ever before. We've done an amazing amount because we have brought a certain will and vigor to Albany, and I think it's a fundamentally different place now than it was 5 months ago because of that. Now, there also, as I said, is a purity to being attorney general. You can be a unilateral decision maker, bring your cases and fight it in court. Now I do need to work with the legislative branch. And so despite the rhetoric, we know how to compromise. I know how to compromise. We're getting a great deal done by saying, here are the parameters of the discussion. Now let's forge something that we can all sign on to. And so we work it out. But I think you need that fortitude, certainly, to challenge and change a system that it was as fundamentally broken as the one that I saw here on January 1st.
Elliot Spitzer, knowing you as I have over the years, you went from being a so-so tennis player at Horace Mann as a kid to the governor of New York State because of fortitude and willfulness. You don't have to apologize for it.
You're hurting me now, Mark, saying I was only a so-so tennis player. You know, and you know how to hurt a guy.
Ellie and I have played, and let me just say we're comparable. So any comment about him is a comment on me. Governor Spitzer, thank you for joining
Mark,
Air America.
Joy to be on the show with you.
That was Mark Green, president of Air America Radio. He'll be live in the studio with us in just a second, and then we'll be continuing with more of the news of the day and your calls at the bottom of the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the headquarters of Air America Radio in New York City. The Tom Hartman Program, and I have live in the studio with me Mark Green, the president of Air America Radio. Great interview, Mark. Air America 2.0 is being launched. Tell us about this.
Tom, great to be on with you. The only man who's written 29 books and remembers them on air, which is a benefit to our audience. Tom, look, Air America Radio was a great idea that stumbled into reality. Although Fox News, or as Robert Greenwald calls them, faux news, for 5 years lost $90 million a year. We are turning it around starting today. It's our relaunch. We have interviews from Redford and Newman to Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. Nancy Scola is a wonderful woman in Brooklyn who's going to be our new blogger, and our website is up today, our brand new website. I invite people, come to airamerica.com and Comment on Nancy's post. We'd like to hear more from you about the issues of the day.
That's great. Mark Green, the president of Air America. Mark, great having you here with us. And thanks so much. It was a great interview with Elliot Spitzer.
Thank you, Tom, for everything.
It's 27 minutes past the hour. I'll be back with the news of the day and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program on Air America Radio.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. Indeed, it's the relaunch of Air America 2.0. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. I just went through the what a lot of frequent flyers refer to as the athlete's foot jungle. I'll tell you, you know, going flying through airports these days, and take off your shoes, and you just have to wonder, you know, it's like what. If you could get a microscope on that floor after a while, what does it, particularly the ones with carpets that are relatively uncleanable. I mean, occasionally airports have floors where you think that maybe at the end of the day they mop them or something, but I can't tell you how many times I have been standing in that security line and had people around me either complaining about having gotten athlete's foot from walking through airports. Thank God I've been able to avoid it so far, but, or about, you know, commenting on, well, you know, I hope I, you know, they're talking about their shoe powder or whatever. It's weird. It's weird. And what's particularly weird about it is that this is so that you can send your shoes through an X-ray machine to look for plastic explosive that Richard Reed had in his shoes that doesn't show up on X-ray machines. Now, somebody explain that one to me. This makes no sense. Right? Plastic explosive doesn't show up on X-ray machines. The fuses are not metallic. It doesn't show up on X-ray machines. But that's why we've got to take our shoes off. It's song and dance. I'm telling you, this whole thing is song and dance. They're still not inspecting the cargo in the bottom of the plane. It's all part of the be afraid, be very afraid political strategy of the Bush administration. And that, by the way, you know, one of the points that was made in the lead editorial, or one of the three lead editorials, the lead editorials of today's New York Times, that the essence of this entire Gonzo Gate, Scandal Gate, whatever, is using the Justice Department to get Republicans elected. And anyhow, the reason why I mentioned the athlete's foot alley, our modern airports, is that up at the top of the thinkprogress.org blog, the Center for American Progress's blog, they talk about how today four members of Congress are going to wrap up their congressional food stamp challenge. Our governor in Oregon, where I live, did this a while ago, where he lived basically on on $3 a day, which is what the food stamp program provides. And we had him on the program. It was tough. And so Tim Ryan, the Democrat from Ohio, he stuck to it right down to the point where the day before he had to give it up, he had to fly, and he ran his bag through security, through TSA, and there was a bag of peanut butter and a can of peanut butter and a can of jelly in there. That was going to be his meal for the next 2 days. And he had a half a pound of cornmeal, and they took the peanut butter and jelly and threw it away. He says, I stepped up to the metal detector, take my shoes off, place my bag through the scanner, come out the other side of the most dreaded words in travel, bag check! As the agent sifted through the bag, I tried to recount what could possibly be in there. Mouthwash, toothpaste, peanut butter and jelly. He politely took the peanut butter and jelly to the side, closed my bag, gave it back to me. I was too astonished to talk. I took my bag and walked toward the gate, thinking about the four or maybe five meals that she had just taken from me. What am I going to do now? It's not like I can just go to Safeway and grab something to eat. He says, I have 33 cents and a bag of cornmeal to last today and tomorrow. Well, he took it in stride. But for some 30 million Americans, it's not just, you know, the absolute level of poverty that is food stamps. It is, I mean, we have, depending on whose numbers you're looking at, somewhere between 10 and 15 million Americans who literally don't know where their next meal is going to come from. So, anyway, it's a remarkable thing. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Nick in Hollywood, California. Hey, Nick, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. As far as that abstinence woman goes, Tom, you've got
back in our first hour. Yeah.
Next time, that these people's definition of virginity. I worked with a church youth group for the last 2 years, and the kid's definition of virginity is not what her definition of virginity is. They are having oral sex like crazy. These 13, 14, 15-year-olds, and they just consider it messing around. And if you ask if they're a virgin, they'll tell you yes. We're a virgin because we don't have vaginal penetration.
Right, and this is one of the big outcomes of this abstinence-only sex education. And ask anybody in the business. You're absolutely right. And all the more the tragedy. I mean, this is the good intentions run amok and unintended consequences. And frankly, what real science could have demonstrated. Again, real science bringing us back to Al Gore's new book, The Assault on Reason. And he's interviewed by Diane Sawyer about a book that points out that people like Diane Sawyer, people in the media, typically focus on fluff rather than substance. And so so in this interview, here she's got him for these few precious minutes on network television. Four different times she asks him if he's going to run for president. Now, this is a book that talks about the serial obsessions of the media. And she keeps serially obsessing on this. And finally, at the end, Al Gore says, you know, the horse race, he says, listen to your own questions. He's mocking he's doing it politely. He says, you know, the horse race, the cosmetic parts of this. And look, that's all understandable and natural. But while we're focusing on, you know, Britney and KFED and Anna Nicole Smith and all this stuff, meanwhile, very quietly, our country has been making some very serious mistakes that could be avoided if we, the people, including the news media, are involved in a full and vigorous discussion of what our choices are. But the news media doesn't want to do that. Just like with Reagan last night or yesterday on Meet the Press or Face the Nation. I guess it's Meet the Press. It's Tim Russ's show. Let's not talk about Reagan's policies. Let's not talk about the damage or the good, frankly, that he did to this country. I mean, if you could find any. I'm not sure I'm much of an expert on that. Instead, let's talk about how he didn't like his kids. Or he did. Or, you know, whatever. I mean, frankly, mind-boggling. Ralph in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hey, Ralph, what's up?
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I think I'd like to drop a name here, Kate Webb. Compare it with Diane Sawyer's interview.
Okay.
Former bureau chief for Cambodia in terms of truth-telling. What I told your screener was that I'm an Eisenhower Republican. And what I meant by that is you're now talking about a huge conflict of interest in the Justice Department, where you've got an attorney general who forgot the oath of office to the Constitution and is a crony of the president.
Right, and he thought he took an oath of office to the Republican Party.
Well, what I'm afraid of, and what I think Eisenhower was afraid of, is that generals, too, have conflicts of interest. And their conflict of interest is to the large defense contractors, and what we've got now is to a, I would say, crony generals for the President of the United States.
Right. When, with regard to the large defense contractors, it wasn't so much of a problem during Eisenhower's time, but now, if you hit two-star general status, you're pretty much guaranteed a $500,000-a-year job in private industry when you retire, and it's a job that's not going to be very, very demanding. And they all know that, and in exchange for that, they suck up to the military-industrial complex throughout their generalship.
Well, but Tom, it gets worse than that, because in order to make 3 and 4 stars, you basically have to suck up to the president.
Right.
Those are political stars.
Yeah.
But what you do is not, you don't get a lot of money while you're in the service. But if you were commander of in the Pacific or wherever, you just have built up, how shall I say, 1 star adds another 0 to your post-military salary.
Yeah, that's my point.
Yeah, but see, that the problem then becomes, Americans are thinking that our generals are as honest as we used to think that our Justice Department was, where you've got a conflict of interest where generals make money, or how shall I say, gain power, by how much they suck up to the president.
In particular, those who stay in power. I mean, the conspicuous exception to that, Ralph, is the collection of generals who have, over the last 2 or 3 years, resigned, given up a good chunk of their pension, and given up probably most of the probability of their getting huge 6- and 7-figure salaries in the defense industry in order to speak out against this war and this president.
Absolutely, and that honesty has cost them millions of dollars.
Yes, and they should be acknowledged for that, and they should be honored for that, and instead they're being trashed for that by this administration and, frankly, many in the media. Ralph, good point, and thank you very much. You said it very well and did it very well. Diana in San Luis Obispo. I can never pronounce that. Diana, tell us how to say your town.
San Luis Obispo.
Thank you.
It used to be Spanish, but, you know, it's very anglicized.
Yeah, I know. I keep wanting to kind of de-anglicize it, and it's, mm-hmm. you know, it's anyway, it's a great town. I've been through it.
Yeah. I just had a couple of quick things. You know, you were talking about connections between Reagan and Bush, all the people who come back and all that. But, you know, I was growing up during the whole big Just Say No thing. I was in, like, junior high school. Mm-hmm. And now they're giving us Just Say No to sex. And
right.
Why do they think that's going to work any better with sex than it did with drugs?
Right. And, in fact, it's even worse because our body produces hormones that drive us to be sexually active.
Yeah.
And drugs are the sort of thing that you really need to experiment with to discover how much fun or how terrible they can be, you know, whatever. I mean, you know, fill in the blank. But
yeah.
It's not I don't think that it's an innate drive as much as, you know, I don't think we can deny that sex is.
Well, and it's so bad towards our women.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
you know,
particularly
it's,
our young women. They tend to be the victims of most of this. They're certainly the ones who are most under assault from the media.
Yeah.
You very, very rarely see teenage boys. You very rarely see young actors or actresses portraying themselves as barely adolescent or pre-adolescent boys, but you see women doing that all the time, and it's the sexualization of progressively younger and younger girls in the media for the purpose of selling goods, and then they wonder, you know, why we have, well, that plus the lack of any kind of an educational program. They wonder why we have these problems. 45 minutes past the hour. More with your calls right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Oh, this is the Jerry Falwell song. I think a lot of people don't realize that Jerry Falwell first came to wealth, fame, and power by opposing integration in the United States. That was his main mantra for the first 15 years of his political, or of his religious career, shall we say. Anyhow, welcome back. 9.5 minutes past the hour, or before the hour, rather. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the nerve center, the mother hive, the central home of Air America Radio in beautiful downtown Manhattan, New York City, New York. Alyssa in Oakland, California, listening on the Quake. Hey, Alyssa, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for all you do first. And my question is, I hope I can articulate it right. Gonzalez, right, and Card were willing to go intimidate Ashcroft in the hospital to get him to sign the program, right? That they decided
to sign off on renewing the illegal spying on you and me program. Yeah.
So when Comey and Ashcroft left, and it became Gonzalez's job to authorize programs like that, what happened? Did he authorize that program again?
Yeah, well, actually, what happened was that about 3 weeks after this, the program was expiring. The program was already ongoing.
Right,
at
and
that
they
point.
Made it.
It was
within
expiring.
The law. But,
right.
But
no,
then,
but about three
but
weeks after that, Bush had a private meeting with Comey, who up to that point had said, no, won't do it.
Right.
And during his private meeting with Comey, for reasons that Comey was unwilling to reveal in public to Congress, decided to sign off on the law. He said that there were a few changes made that made it acceptable to him. And then, of course, Gonzalez replaced Ashcroft, and ever since then, it's God only knows what's happened.
That's what
been,
I mean.
Yeah, there's been
with
no,
that program.
Yeah,
no, has anybody asked him, like, did you go back and relook at that program?
Well, there's been no serious investigation of this, and when Congress tries to ask Gonzalez questions about this, typically the kind of response they get is, I don't remember, or I'm not sure, or, you know, the kind of question that A, allows you not to lie and go to jail, and on the other hand, allows you not to tell the truth and point out that the Bush administration has been spying on us and probably everybody
exactly.
in the Democratic Party as well. Yeah, so it's pretty grim. Alyssa, thanks for the call, though. Interesting one. Eric in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Eric.
Hey there. How you doing, Tom?
Great. What's up?
Hey, I'm NLP trained, and when I demonstrate to people how susceptible they are to linguistic manipulation, they always freak out without exception. And I think if the general public knew how well-structured and crafted these speeches are, I think they'd have the same effect.
Well, it's not just the speeches. It was interesting yesterday on the Tim Russert program, Meet the Press. He had Newt Gingrich on. And Gingrich was doing these, you know, obviously speech pieces. You know,
yeah.
It was very well rehearsed, very well memorized. You know, and it would be like, you know, six or seven sentences which had four or five frames in them, each one which would take a paragraph to refute. And,
oh, yeah, absolutely.
And, you know,
and the ambiguity, it's absolutely artful.
Yeah, it truly is. It really
also,
truly is.
I also heard that didn't Tony Robbins work extensively with Clinton during his presidency?
I believe Tony Robbins was a consultant at one point to Clinton. I don't know whether it was, you know, he came in and did a 20-minute seminar for Clinton and his buddies or even for his buddies or whether he worked closely with him. I don't know. But,
so what I'm thinking is if they gave credits for who wrote the speech, like after the presidential, you know, when he talks, if they give credits like on a movie.
Yeah, they should.
That'd be poignant.
It would really change things. It really would. Eric, good point. Thanks a lot. Rob in Long Island, New York. Hey, Rob, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to ask you a question because I do really value your opinion, and I like the way that you talk because you kind of try to teach people instead of just talking at them. And my question is this. Conservatives, there seems to be this conventional wisdom that conservatives hate government.
Right.
Wouldn't you argue more towards the point that the conservatives believe in government to the highest bidder?
No, I would take it to a third area. I first of all, I would say that that's the consequence of a lot of perhaps misguided conservative philosophy. But the true conservatives believe in government. They just think that government's role should be to limit evil human behavior, whether it's domestically or internationally. And in other words, strong police, strong army, end of discussion. And the traditional liberal worldview, going all the way back to George Washington, is that that is a purpose of government, but not the only purpose of government or the exclusive purpose of government. Instead, the government has additional purposes. I mean, there were six of them listed in the preamble to the Constitution of the United States. Only one was to provide for the common defense. And the other five all had to do with basically backstopping us, being available to us, making sure that we all have the ability to reach our highest potential. Conservatives would argue that that's not the business of government. Liberals would argue that that's the whole reason why government was formed. And that's where they're typically cleaving.
Because it seems to me like in its purest form, the conservative view isn't like a bad idea. Fiscal responsibility, limited government. But it seems...
Well, those are also liberal ideas.
You know, it seems to me like when you get to the point where you've got conservative rule, that all goes by the way.
Right. Well, see, what happens is the conservatives talk about limited government, and really it's code words for things like no Social Security, no unemployment insurance, no national health insurance, or no Medicare or no Medicaid, and all those kinds of things, because they don't think that government should be involved in social programs. I mean, that's the bottom line. And so then you get to the problem of what probably is what you're really talking about here, Rob, is that what happens is when conservatives take over government, whether it was Reagan or whether it's, you know, Bush Jr. here, they were the first two really serious conservative presidents. Eisenhower was a liberal. When conservatives take over government, they've got all these instruments of government that they don't believe in. You know, the education department, the FEMA, the Social Security, Medicare, they don't believe in this stuff. So, but they do believe in wealth and power, and they do believe in a small, educated, elite aristocracy ruling the country. They think that's the most stable thing. They think we should have a meritocracy, not a hereditary aristocracy, but a meritocracy. So if you've got control of these institutions that you don't believe in, what do? You either screw them up or you use them to hand off money to your friends and buddies. And so what they do is they put their friends and buddies in control of them and use them as tools to enrich themselves. Because they don't believe in their being there in the first place anyway, so what the heck? Hey, you know, they're not going to be able to get rid of them. Congress isn't going to make the EPA go away. So let's put somebody in charge who's going to help make industry more money, and that industry then will funnel more money back to us in the form of campaign contributions. That's what happens when you get people governing who don't believe in government. 57 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Welcome to the Democracy Zone.
It's the relaunch of Air America Radio, Air America 2.0. Check out airamerica.com, our all-new, highly interactive G-Wiz. Holy cow, lots of cool stuff there, website. Also, if you want to drop into our live chat room, hopefully, I need to double-check this. You never know. Murphy's Law, right? But hopefully at airamerica.com, you can click right on Tom Hartman there, and it should get you right to it. And if not, you can always go to TomHartman.com, click live chat up at the top of the page, but we'll make sure that it gets all working properly. Last week, I interviewed briefly David Brooks, a columnist on the op-ed page of the New York Times, senior editor of the Weekly Standard, a contributing editor at Newsweek. This is one of the series of interviews that are being done by Air America right across the board on all of our various shows to roll out as part of the rollout of Air America 2.0. Today and tomorrow, we're going to be doing these kind of things. This is my interview with David Brooks. We have David Brooks with us, the New York Times columnist and man about town, author, and David Brooks, welcome to the program.
Good to be here. Good to be with my base.
Yeah, indeed. you actually wrote a fascinating op-ed in the New York Times titled "The Grim Old Party," and you said that the Republicans in Congress were just following sullenly along, and they're like people quietly marching to their doom. What is the doom that you envision that the Republican Party, or that many Republicans in elected office, are marching toward?
Well, I guess for a lot of office holders, the doom is unemployment, imminent unemployment. I mean, you don't have to be a genius to look at what the polls are. The Democrats have a pretty high name advantage or a partisan identification advantage. And the Democrats are doing particularly well with people under 30. So, you know, we would think that people would respond rationally to that prospect, and they would change their party. They would. The public clearly wants something new, something fresh. And so you would think Republicans would be burbling forth with ideas to offer some fresh profile from the party. And what strikes me, reporting on Capitol Hill in particular, is a sort of passivity. They're not happy, but they're not really doing anything about it. And even among the candidates, they spend a lot of time talking about Ronald Reagan, which is the past, but not really offering much in the future. And the big difference is privately they're in despair and very angry and unhappy. Publicly, they're inhibited. And so I tried to describe the forces inhibiting them. They're sort of a team spirit that's inhibiting them. There's special interest groups on the left as well as on the right, which inhibit them from, you know, breaking out of some of the normal positions on abortion, on taxes, and a few other things. And then there's just sort of a conformity, a shock of suffering what's happened over the last few years. So they're sort of a bunker mentality. I think they're stuck in.
The Republican Party, I mean, if you go back to Eisenhower once made the comment, and I don't have the quote in front of me, but it was words to the effect of, there are a few people in the Republican Party who think that you can do away with social programs like Social Security, and they are mostly a few eccentric Texas oil millionaires, and they are wrong. they're stupid, I think Eisenhower called them. And yet that has been the essence, particularly since Ronald Reagan, of the Republican, the thrust of the Republican Party has been to undo the New Deal. It's, you know, Rush Limbaugh famously saying, you know, Roosevelt is dead, but his programs live on, and we're in the process of doing something about that. And that's sort of been the mantra. Most of America doesn't seem to want to go along with that, and to the extent that the Republican Party has had successes in rolling back the New Deal, it doesn't seem to be very popular with the people. How do they reinvent themselves as a party without going back to that philosophical base of, you know, let's go back to the time of the robber barons? Or is that even possible?
Yeah, I guess I might have a slightly different history of the Republican Party there. I think in the 1990s, the Gingrich-Tom DeLay revolution, that was about cutting back the size of the state. I think they wanted to reduce the size of the state 25%, whatever that can possibly mean. But I think Bush actually came in with a very different philosophy. He came in with this compassionate conservative philosophy. And indeed, George Bush has spent twice as much on domestic spending, or has increased domestic spending, stuff on education, welfare, unemployment, twice as fast as Jimmy Carter, and he's increased it more than Lyndon Johnson. And I don't think he was ever that interested in quibbling with the New Deal. He did want to reform Social Security to create private accounts, but government was still going to be paying for it. It was just a question of whether you'd go to private accounts or keep the same old system. So I think Bush was offering something which was not libertarianism, and I think Bush personally is quite anti-libertarian, quite against the idea that the party's main role is to cut the size of government. He wanted to increase the size of government. The problem was they never really developed it as a public philosophy. So the Republicans, especially in Congress, took really which was sort of a pro-spending philosophy, and they turned it into a mindless splurge of pork barrel spending. So spending has certainly increased under Bush much faster than under Clinton, as I say, but it's done so without too much effect, and it's just turned into deficits without really much social experimentation.
Which brings us back to, I guess, the essence of my last question. Reagan famously said, there are no good people in government. If there were, they would have been hired away by a corporation. Reagan famously said, the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government, I'm here to help. George W. Bush, to a large extent, has been... Well, it gets down to this concept that if you don't believe in government, if you don't believe in government as a positive, proactive force, how can you govern competently?
Yeah, see, I do think he did believe in government as a positive force, and if you look at a lot of things he did, No Child Left Behind, it's a gigantic increase in government power over schools and a federalizing of educational authority. Welfare reform was a big increase in government authority and rules about welfare reform.
But if I just to take No Child Left Behind, Jim Jeffords, at the time that happened, I lived in Vermont. He was my senator, and I spoke with him and I spoke with his staff at some length about this. I mean, as you'll recall, this is what he left the Republican Party over. And they did a study. The Congressional Research Service did a study, which Jeffords shared with me, and I wrote about in one of my books, in which they pointed out that the main effect of No Child Left Behind was going to be to take a $400 million a year educational testing industry and turn it into a $2 billion a year educational testing industry. An industry, by the way, in which George W. Bush's brother is making very good money now, thank you very much. And his mother made a donation to Hurricane Katrina only if it would be given to his brother for that testing industry. I mean, it was basically just testing. That's not the classic liberal notion, or for that matter, the classic American notion of government as a proactive, positive force. That's just, you know, moving money around to help out your friends.
Yeah, see, again, this is actually a good example. I mean, what Bush did with this, and I think it's exemplary, what he did was he rejected what had been 25 years of Republican thinking about education, which was going to be vouchers and school choice. And that really was where the Republican Party was. Bush really rejected that. There's really no vouchers or school choice in what he did on education. He decided, he took a much more business-like or corporate approach to the problem, which was we don't have standards and we don't have tests. We don't know what kind of outputs we're doing. And so he created this system of testing. Now, I don't even know if it helped his brother or not, but certainly the people who supported No Child Left Behind in the states and elsewhere did believe you needed tests. And I was sort of skeptical of it, but I have to say that when I talk to people about No Child Left Behind, the first thing I hear is from a lot of teachers a lot of complaining because there's a lot of perverse incentives built into the system. And it really does inhibit at the creativity of teachers. And those are legitimate complaints. But the other thing, when you take a look at the results, it actually has measurably narrowed the gap between African Americans and whites. It has improved some of the performance in math, and in, especially in math, but a little in reading. So you have to say it's a complicated picture. And so what I guess what I'm trying to do is belie the notion that Bush came in wanting to destroy government, destroy the New Deal. I do think there was a spasm of that in the Republican parties in the 90s. But Bush is a more complicated figure. I would say his problem was not in wanting to destroy government. His problem was in never being that interested in executing government,
yeah.
in knowing how to use the power of government to accomplish things. But it was not his intention. It was his disinterest in execution that I would say was the core of his problem.
We're talking with David Brooks, the New York Times columnist. Last question, sir. Where do the Republicans go from here?
Well, I think they have the potential to go in a much more positive direction. It may take a few election cycles. Some days the party reminds me of the British Conservative Party after John Major lost and Tony Blair took over, something that takes 10 years to get back on its feet. But, you know, John McCain in his heart of hearts and Rudy Giuliani, they're not normal orthodox Republicans. Neither is Fred Thompson, frankly, in his heart of hearts. So they could come up with something new. And it has to be said, the Democrats, while I think they have huge advantages going into the next election, the Democratic Congress's poll numbers are now, I think they've dropped 10, 15 points since they took office, and they're down about where the Republican Congress was.
Mm-hmm.
So the Democrats haven't actually yet built anything positive, which gives the Republicans some advantage. But I think you really have to begin among the scholars with the ideas. The blunt fact is, and I say this as someone who's worked National Review and a lot of conservative outfits, in the 70s there was just a lot more intellectual creativity than there is now. Now there are fewer good books, more blogs, and I think that's had a bad effect, which the Republican Party is feeling.
Interesting. David Brooks, thank you so much for being with us here on the relaunch of the 2.0 of Air America Radio.
And good luck to you guys.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good talking. David Brooks, columnist on the op-ed page of the New York Times, senior editor of the Weekly Standard, contributing editor of Newsweek. 17 minutes past the hour, it's the Tom Hartman Program.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Make it work here in America. We're going to bring this country back around. Not to worry. Tom Hartman here with you. 22 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman radio program on Air America Radio as we relaunch Air America, Air America 2.0. Ellen Ratner with us with the Talk Radio News Service on the line, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
How are you doing? Well, listen to this. Harry Reid has finally gotten smart and maybe a little religion, although not our kind of religion. He is essentially saying that they are going to have a pro forma session every 10 days while they're out so that they can say that Congress is not in recess and Bush cannot make any recess appointments.
That is so cool. I read about that yesterday over at the Center for American Progress's blog. In fact, I meant to mention it earlier, and I don't have my sound effects with me. Give him the Jolly Good Fellow music behind it, and thank you for bringing it up.
But Mr. Boehner sent a letter to Nancy Pelosi today, signed by 193 Republican members of Congress, said they are going to work through recess, and if she does not come up with a way of funding the troops, that they are going to work through the recess, and they're going to have, you know, press conferences every day and try and embarrass the Democrats for not funding the troops.
Oh, gee. I mean, this is news.
I understand, but they normally would just leave with their tail behind their legs, but
yeah.
now they're going to try and fight.
Well, I think it's important that the truth be told here, Ellen. Do a reality check with me. They're not fighting to make sure that the troops are getting body armor, or that the troops are getting what they need, or that the troops are getting proper rotation, or the troops are able to be home with their families and keep their marriages intact, or that our National Guard can come back here.
But the White House, as you say,
they're fighting for politics.
Right, and the White House is fighting a salary increase for the troops.
Right, of $6 a month. From 3 to 3.5%. They say it's too much. $6 a month for our troops, too much money.
I mean, these guys...
Why is the press not...
He's not making some political ads out of this because...
Well, not only that, why is the press not raising hell about it?
Oh, well, the press, okay. They're not necessarily the smartest bulbs in the socket. But with all the YouTube stuff and all the move-on stuff, why is somebody not getting that advertisement on television? Because that would really prove it, that they speak with forked tongue.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right, and it should happen.
A couple other interesting things.
Sure.
It looks like when Mr. Wolfowitz manages to leave the World Bank that a lot of his staffers are going to go with him. A lot of people are saying that there's going to be a Wolfowitz staffer purge.
Baruch Hashem. Thank God.
Nancy Pelosi is saying that she's not going to bring up that immigration bill unless 70 Republicans support it. So this immigration bill, which is being debated as we speak in the Senate, and of course what's happening is Harry Reid wants it to go on and to wants to really not get a vote by Friday, but to wait until people kind of sit on this after they go back to their districts, and the Mitch McConnell wants to push a vote on this by Friday.
Can we spend a minute on this, Ellen?
Sure.
Help me understand the political calculus here. I mean, I've been reading about this. I've been watching the talking heads and whatnot. Clearly, there are Republicans and Democrats on both sides of this issue. People are all over the place. It looks to me like this is really a two-tiered program, one designed to increase the number of people who will overtly compete with the American middle class. That is, the more highly skilled illegal immigrants will have a very quick path because they have higher incomes. They can afford to pay the fees and things. They'll have a quick path to citizenship.
Right.
And the poorly skilled ones instead will get these Z visas, and they'll basically be slaves. And if their employer threatens or does fire them, boom, they get kicked out of the country. They lose their visa. So they're essentially slaves. How is this? First of all, is my analysis right in your opinion? And secondly, how are the politicians handling it? And third, we only have about 30 seconds. I'm sorry.
Well, the politician, I mean, you're right. This is a coalition between a lot of sort of the labor people who are very worried about people being, you know, rounded up and sent to jail and their families suffering, and therefore they're sort of content to do with these Z visas, which I don't really understand, but apparently they are. And then you have the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which is saying cheap labor, cheap labor, cheap labor.
Well, see,
and
the
that
Z visas,
is really the coalition.
The Z visas won't compete with the unions. It's the Y visas that will compete with the unions. And
right, but and also the green cards in some respects.
Right, but a lot of those people are already members of the unions because
exactly.
The unions have been since 2000. The unions have been accepting illegal immigrants. So
exactly, you're talking about maybe 11 million green cards.
Wow. Yeah. It's just a fascinating thing to watch all these different currents, and they're really, I've really come to conclude that there are no simple answers to this thing, but I don't think that this piece of legislation is the answer, just my personal opinion. Anyhow, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Ellen, thanks so much for being
here. Thank you.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Senator John McCain, still crazy after all these years. He offers this response to the criticism of his immigration plan. John McCain says, in the case of Governor Romney, Maybe I should wait a couple of weeks and see if it changes, because it's changed in less than a year from his position a year before, and maybe his solution will be to get out his small varmint gun and drive those Guatemalans off his lawn. Yeah, right. Anyhow, it's welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 35 minutes past the hour. We're rolling out Air America 2.0, and today and tomorrow, this two-day rollout, and then our show will be pretty much back to normal. Part of our rollout, part of this rollout process, is a whole variety of us who are talent here on Air America are playing interviews that we ourselves have done and that other members of the Air America family have done with various people. And this is a fascinating interview that David Bender did with Howard Dean. Howard Dean, of course, the chairman of the Democratic National Committee.
Governor Howard Dean, welcome to the Air Americans.
Thanks for having me on, and congratulations on the relaunch.
Well, we're excited about it, and I've got to ask you, it's really interesting that we're looking at media now, and so much is going on in terms of Don Imus and the focus on responsibility in media. One of the things we're proudest of here is we're trying to give a voice that is somewhat of a balance. How important is that, when you were out there as part of the 50-state strategy, how important was it that there was a balance, particularly on radio, in the world?
Well, as you know, right-wing radio is, I call it hate radio, and it takes advantage of the very worst that people have to offer. They're always appealing to people's bigotry and people's prejudices and racism and all that other stuff. So what I like to think of Air America as, a place for optimism and ideas, and I think that's really, by and large, what it's been. We need a place where Americans can tune in and listen to things that are going to be good about America and different ways of doing things and not the kind of fear-mongering and hate-mongering that goes on the right.
Speaking of which, last week we saw the passing of Jerry Falwell, and Republicans were jumping all over themselves to eulogize him. What do you think his legacy is to the political process and to the Republican Party?
I think he's been an incredibly divisive person in terms of American history. He did appeal sometimes to the very worst in people, the anti-gay stuff, the racism that was going on at Liberty University with white folks not being able to date black folks and stuff like that. So, you know, it's a mixed bag. He certainly was a potent political force in the Republican Party, but in some ways he represented the worst of the Republican Party.
And we saw what was so interesting, that the debate a few weeks ago, Republicans raising their hands, three Republican candidates saying they didn't believe in the theory of evolution. Isn't this part and parcel of appealing to the Falwells, the Pat Robertsons, this Republican Party?
Those folks are a passing generation. The Democrats are actually starting to reach out to evangelicals. Young evangelicals would rather hear about what we're going to do about Darfur, poverty, and global warming than they would beat up on their gay neighbor. And that's something that, you know, in some ways, Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson and Oral Robertson, these people are dinosaurs. You know, they're people who represent the kind of the anger part of Christianity, and there really is no justifiable anger part of Christianity. They're showmen, they make money off it. But the new generation are people that are sort of emphasizing what was really in Jesus' message, which had to do with reaching out to people, taking care of the least among us. It's a much more American message, and the young, smart evangelical preachers are creating these huge congregations with that kind of a message of hope. And that's something the Democrats can work with, and I'm looking forward to that.
Well, you have been reaching out to that. We've talked about that in the past. And I want to, that's a perfect opportunity to talk about the fact that you have not written off any state in the union. I want to sort of tick this off. In 2 years as chairman, and it's a small list of accomplishments, Governor, the Democrats took control of the House of Representatives, took control of the Senate, won a majority of the nation's governorships, and added 10 new chambers in state legislatures. Now, that's an extraordinary thing. Of course, and then James Carville said you should step down the next day because that makes sense.
The generations are passing in every institution, including ours. But look, I didn't do all that stuff myself. I mean, without Chuck Schumer, we don't win the Senate. Without Rahm Emanuel, we don't win the House. It was a team effort. But what we did do is go into new territory, a territory like Kansas and Minnesota, upstate New York, territories that hadn't been aggressively attacked. And, you know, of course, we're delighted that we won the majority in the House and the Senate, but the really exciting thing is that we forced the president and the vice president to be campaigning in Idaho and Nebraska the last two weekends of the campaign.
You put them on defense.
You've got to be playing offense all the time. When you start playing defense, which we've been doing for 30 years, then you're not winning. And now we're winning. And we're winning because we're asking everybody for their vote. There's not a vote that I'm afraid to ask for. We do not have to give up our principles to ask people who don't agree with us for their votes. People will respect you if you respect them. And that's something that we've learned by watching the terrible mistakes of the president. The president has not just been incompetent because of his policy mistakes. He's been incompetent because he set out from the beginning of his presidency to only be the president of half the people. And we want to be the president of all the people, including those who don't vote for us.
And you took the words out of my mouth because, in fact, not giving up our principles involves being able to stand strong in opposing this war. And we saw candidates in unlikely places, people like Jim Webb in Virginia, John Tester in Montana, who in red states ran against this war and won majorities.
That's right. I think that people understand now that when you don't tell the truth about why you're going to war, the war effort's likely not to be successful. And the president and his folks just simply didn't tell America the truth.
I've asked you this before, Governor. What does it feel like to have been approximately 4 years ahead of your time? You were a lonely voice calling, within the Democratic Party, I might point out, calling for an end to this war. How did it feel to you watching people come around?
You were part of that campaign, and I think you remember the day that I said capturing Saddam Hussein does not make us any safer, which created a huge uproar. Unfortunately, I told you so is not a good campaign slogan. So I'm happy doing what I'm doing, and we have a great field, a real really, really great field of people running for president. It's a great time to be the chairman of the DNC. I'm really looking forward to having our presidential candidate win.
Well, and lastly, I see that there are going to be a number of debates, now officially sanctioned debates, which were just announced recently, six of them between now and the end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
I want to ask you, would you think it appropriate for Air America to be a part of that coverage?
Well, we're not going to be partners with anybody sanctioning the debates because that was the agreement that we made with the candidates, but I think there will be other debates besides the ones we sanction. And, you know, I think Air America should cover those debates. In fact, there's nothing to prevent you, as far as I know, from doing that.
Well, we did that with a Move On town hall meeting, and that got a great response. And we look forward to participating in these because we want our audience to hear what these candidates are saying. Governor Howard Dean, thank you for joining us on the Air Americans. We'll look forward to talking to you soon.
Thank you for having me.
Air America host David Bender, one of my colleagues here, interviewing Howard Dean. 41 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Yeah, it's really time to start fixing things, you know, setting them straight, making them right. 46 minutes past the hour, by the way. This, Paul Krugman today, as always, or as so often, Paul Krugman is one of the most stand-up guys writing in the New York Times. He's sort of the anti-Tom Friedman in a way, for me. I mean, obviously not in his own mind and probably not in Tom Friedman's mind, but, you know, the voice of economic rationality in the New York Times. And he talks about the Bush administration, even as we are importing more and more of our food, and even as the food that we're not importing, we're discovering is being contaminated with all these superbugs now, E. coli, 147H7 or whatever it is, and salmonella and some really vicious forms, and more and more Americans are dying from these things, not to mention just the garden variety, I shouldn't eat on the, you know, that airplane meal kind of food poisoning, which, you know, I can raise my hand to having experienced more than once. He says, why would the administration refuse to regulate an industry that actually wants to be regulated? See, the food industry says, great, use tax dollars to make sure that we're providing good, clean products. That's fine with us. Yeah, well, says Paul Krugman, officials may fear that they would create a precedent for public interest regulation of other industries. They're also influenced. Now, this is the key, and these are the people that you hear on this program all the time. You know, when we get the relatively honest conservatives in the program who will tell you what their real and true ideological beliefs are, what their real true worldview is, as Paul Krugman writes today in today's New York Times, but they are also influenced by an ideology that says business should never be regulated, no matter what. goes on to say, the economic case for having a government enforce rules on food safety seems overwhelming. Consumers have no way of knowing whether the food they eat is contaminated. And in this case, you don't even what you don't know can hurt or even kill you. But there are some people who refuse to accept that case because it's ideologically inconvenient. That's why, writes Paul Krugman, that's why I blame the food society crisis on Milton Friedman. Milton Friedman, the Chicago school economist who recently passed away, who really was the godfather to Reaganomics, Bushonomics, some aspects, certainly the laissez-faire aspects of Clintonomics, and Bush and W-nomics. He wraps it up saying, earlier, Paul Krugman, earlier this month, the administration named, you guessed it, a food safety czar. But the food safety crisis isn't caused by the arrangement of boxes on an organizational chart. It's caused by the dominance within our government of a literally sickening ideology. Literally sickening. Because, you know, if you're not going to regulate food, then you're going to end up with sick people. But these cons say, but, you know, you get sick people, they'll figure out that I shouldn't buy Acme brand food because it's not safe. And then Acme brand will go out of business. The free market will do its work. Yeah, sure. Maybe. First of all, after a few hundred people have died, or in a country this large, a few thousand, maybe even a few million. And what if Acme decides to do business under 25 different names? Man, it is so time to just lay out the conservative agenda for what it honestly is. And it has genuinely been concealed for the better part of 26 years. People of Eisenhower's generation understood it. People of Roosevelt's generation understood it. This generation does not understand the conservative agenda, and they need to learn it because it's whacking them hard. Gary in Scottsdale, Arizona. Hey, Gary, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, blink twice if you don't believe in evolution.
okay.
Thank you. The new Republican credo is being Reagan-esque. Reagan talked about trickle-down economics.
Right.
And how by giving corporations tax dollars, they would be creating jobs for people, for more people. The better business did, the more better people would of the country do, the more better Americans would do. The translation of that is give the corporations tax dollars to subsidize private industry to make jobs disappear through mergers.
Yeah, well, that's how it worked out. I mean, the idea, I think, for the marketing of the idea was the rich will build factories with that money. And, of course,
Correct.
They did in Mexico and in China.
Correct,
But the real conservative ideologues, the neoconservative ideologues, the Straussians, and really even I'd say the Friedman followers,
mm-hmm.
the people who believe that a liberal society is a dangerous society and the democracy, true democracy, in a republic, true representative, constitutionally limited representative democracy is a dangerous thing because if the people have too much power, then you're going to have things like you had in the 60s and the 70s.
You're going to have social unrest.
Exactly. This is the argument that Jefferson and John Adams had.
Mm-hmm.
Those true conservatives will say that their real goal was to create trickle-down economics that would produce a nation of peons. And that's exactly what they did. And, you know, because they intentionally wanted to disenfranchise I say that as a bad pun, but they wanted to disenfranchise an entire middle class economically so that they would then become politically disenfranchised.
Goes back to the 13th Amendment after the Civil War, where after the slaves were freed, they were then imprisoned for loitering.
Right.
And instead of
among other things.
Among other things. But they were then forced into labor where they were paid less, treated worse, and this went on for a long time. But, you know, in wanting to speak about Reagan, anyone who wants to support Reagan, and I'm not a Democrat nor a Republican, but anyone who wants to support Reagan should understand that this is a gentleman who, in his will and trust, left instructions that his land could not be sold to a black man. This is a guy who...
Ronald Reagan, before he became president.
Yes. Yeah. Well, through his will and trust. I assume it was done before he...
It was actually done, I believe, before he became governor of California.
Yes. And Reagan signaled the beginning of the end. And I think
by the way, just to cut Reagan a little bit of slack, The defense that was given when that came out in the press was that that was standard language in wills that were drawn around that time. This was like in the late 1950s. And as in fact, I believe that it might well have been, you know.
Depending upon where you lived, depending upon what your mentality was.
Exactly, yeah. And depending on what lawyer you hired.
Exactly.
But, you know, I'm not ready to paint Ronald Reagan with the brush of a racist. I think being economically ignorant and being a tool of big business is bad enough. You know, being sucked into the neocon cabal is bad enough. And frankly, you know, not having the good graces as he was losing his mind slowly to say so to the American people and say, you know, really it's time to invoke the 25th Amendment, I think it is, that says the president's incompetent and it's time to do something about this. Of course, I guess arguably at that point you could say he wasn't responsible for not being responsible. But
you can take that route if you choose to. I just see Reagan as being someone who began dismantling our country. Our current president George Bush wishes to restrict the amount that corporations can be liable for, regardless of what crimes they commit.
Right, but not restrict the amount of campaign contributions that they can give.
That's correct.
Yeah. Good point. Gary, got to move along. I appreciate the call. Georgie in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Georgie.
Hi, how are you today, Tom? Enjoy your show.
Thank you. I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Okay, now you're pretty good already.
Thank you.
I guess being an ex-career government employee, I have this to say about how the Republicans and conservatives view government. I think that there's a lack of understanding on the general public's part and on the part of people in the government, exactly how the government operates and what amount of integrity, for the most part, that government employees operate with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important to understand that, because when you look at things that are happening, for example, with the Blackwater contracts, there is no accountability.
That's right.
In government when you go to a private company.
Yeah,
there's
you're absolutely right. And this is one of the reasons, and good point, Georgie, and this is one of the reasons why George W. Bush wanted to, and still wants to. I mean, he's pretty upfront about it. Take over 750,000 civil servants and replace them with, quote, private contractors or, quote, independent workers. He wants to break the back of the unions, basically, the government employees unions. And the main reason why is because you have people in government who are actually committed to doing their job. They see it as a career. They see it as 30 years in and then out with a decent pension. They see it as a job with good health care. They care so much about their job that they're not going to stand passively and idly by when some ideologue like Bush or like Reagan or their minions, you know, the Wolfowitzes of the world. I mean, this is what happened to the World Bank. When some ideologue comes in and tries to completely transform, you know, the whole goal of the whole thing and screw it all up, they're just not going to easily put up with that. And so it should be. I mean, it should be that they're not going to. But in any case, we'll see. We'll see how it all shakes up. Thanks so much for being with us today. Tomorrow we will be back with more of the launch of Air America 2.0. I'll be broadcasting live tomorrow from our New York City affiliate, WWRL. Should be great fun and a fine time for all. The news of the day, your calls, and we'll have a few more interviews as time goes on. So thanks so much for being with us. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.